it probably won't happen. The time to convert our petroleum infrastructure to something different or a steady state economy, that chance was back in the 1970s. It takes so long to regear, retool, and replace an infrastructure. There is not time for this.
That was Jan Lundberg speaking about petrocollapse at a forum on peak oil, realities and solutions of the looming petroleum shortage. In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will hear an excerpt from that forum, which was held on January 28th of 2006 at the Valley City's Jewish Community Center in Sherman Oaks, California. The program of music, film, and a panel was presented by Neighbors for Peace and Justice of the San Fernando Valley and supported by many groups, including the LA Post Carbon Institute and KPFK. Jan Lundberg is an oil industry analyst, founder of Auto Free Times and Culture Change, which can be found at www.culturechange.org. Mimi Kennedy introduces Jan Lundberg and later presents him with questions from the large audience.
The next person that I have to introduce is our speaker for this evening. And I asked him, Jan Lundberg, what he would like me to say. And he said, well, how far back do you want to go? And I said, I always like to know where someone is born. And he went, well, Mexico. He grew up in L.A., he said, and at age 13, he sailed with his family in the family boat to the Mediterranean, where he went to school. He came back here, UCLA, and he wanted to go into environmental work. It was anti-war. It was 1972. At this point, he told me, because my family was into the oil industry, they ran the Lundberg Survey, which was, in fact, an objective market research service for the oil companies. The Lundberg Survey since, he said, is taken over by a much more oil-friendly, so he doesn't consider it quite so independent. And he has branched off into fantastically fruitful environmental work. I will let him tell you about that, but in general, he has his culture change, and there is a website, and he is working now to educate us all about what he saw coming in 1988 and began educating people about. So I really can't wait to hear what he has to say. Welcome to the podium, Jan Lundberg.
Thanks, Mimi. That film really is fantastic, and I've been privileged to show it a few places. We held a conference in New York City called Petrocollapse in October. It's really an honor to be here. This is quite a good gathering, of course. I'm a local boy, so it's really sort of a point of pride. I used to have an apartment near here. My first home was Canoga Park. It was an organic ranch, and you know, before they paved it over, of course. And I used to work in North Hollywood, the Lundberg Survey, and I guess a sort of a defining moment was all of a sudden the vacant lot, which was a vacant lot next to it, which was a beautiful drought-resistant garden, all of a sudden got paved over by the church across the street overnight, just wall-to-wall, just blacktop. So this is really my hometown. And I was doing environmental activism at UCLA, but I reluctantly dropped it because the family business was something that I had a lot of pride in, and my father was working 8 days a week. So I did go into the family business. My first job was to look at the share of market of the oil companies, and I was really shocked to add up the figures for the country, all the brands, all the states, and all the months. And so for a year's time, I saw about 100 billion gallons of gasoline used in this country every year. And to me, I thought, okay, that's gasoline burned and spilled. And I thought, how can this go on? How can they do it year after year? How can the earth take it? But it was quite an education, and we were able to help various agencies, such as EPA, get lead out of gasoline. The Department of Energy was started up in part to try to replicate what we were doing. And The work became pretty interesting by the time the 1979 crisis triggered by the Iranian Revolution started cranking up. We predicted the second oil shock in 1979, and that's how the Lundberg Survey and Lundberg Letter name was pretty well known at that time. Just to, I guess, finish out my little biography, I continued in that job. It got pretty interesting, and we looked at alternative fuels. Natural gas prices were set according to our surveys. And I left rather abruptly, escaped Los Angeles, and was doing my thing back east. And one day I decided, this really isn't for me. If I have to pay people to do survey work of gasoline stations that I don't really want to do, I'm not going to pay people to do that. So I launched into the nonprofit environmental field. And our first project of note was for a national paving moratorium, because the Amtrak support lobby wanted some help from somebody who knew something about oil. And Amtrak being the most energy efficient, least polluting form of motorized transportation in this country, it seemed like a really good thing to get behind to stop new road construction. And out of that flowed the Alliance for a Paving Moratorium, the Auto Free Times, and that was my real education. Learning about oil came after my period of serving the oil industry and government. And peak oil did become known to me in 1988. And we wrote about it. Some of the folks in the movie were watching what we're doing with our obscure international magazine. But it really didn't become interesting until a few years ago, hence this wonderful crowd here. So to sort of round out my personal odyssey in this movement, it all became culturechange.org, and I've been traveling around the country a lot in the last several months giving talks on what I call Petro Collapse, and showing this movie and another movie called Our Synthetic Sea about plastics pollution. I do media interviews. I bring my guitar along and sing Have a Global Warming Day. And when I'm not doing that, I'm in Berkeley at home fighting plastics. The idea... What I think we can do is look forward to the first town, I'm not sure which one, but somewhere on this continent, somewhere is going to pass an ordinance requiring that fees be put on the plastic bags we get at the supermarkets. Other countries do it. Ireland got rid of its plastic bag trash problem virtually overnight. 95% of it just went away with a 15-cent fee. So it can be done here. We're paying for it already, just in different ways. We're paying a lot more than that when you tally it all up. So I think it's going to be Arcata, where I used to live, or Santa Barbara. They may be the first to do it. But make it your town, your municipality, or this county. It's really not that hard. But San Francisco, it was ready to do it, and the plastics lobby got to the mayor, is what I'm told. So it's not a slam dunk. The beauty of looking at plastics and questioning our consumption of plastics, which I have come to regard as filth, because poisons are just monumental coming into our bodies. Migration into food, into water, into our skin is major. Things like bisphenol A, which are in the hard plastics in the seals of the bottle caps, jar caps, Nalgene water bottles, baby bottles, the inner lining of cans. We can look at phthalates, the softeners in plastics, highly poisonous PVC, which should have been banned a long time ago. So this plastic plague is like a gigantic global oil spill that began decades ago, still going on. If we turn it off right now, plastics do not biodegrade. We'd be stuck with it for hundreds and hundreds of years. There's about six times as much plastic debris floating in the middle of the Pacific than zooplankton. That's the krill, the beginning of the food chain. So this plastic disaster is a good thing for us to think about, because it's needless petroleum consumption. So we can get a handle on what we have to regard as something we have to phase out immediately, because peak oil is here, petro collapse coming, and I'll talk more about that soon. So we can get it out of our lives. It's not easy to do at first, but when you begin this process, it really isn't so hard. Now, if I look awfully thin, it's not because I haven't been getting enough food because it was tainted with plastic. I went on an 18-day fast of just water that ended 2 weeks ago. And I feel great, so I'm going to have to gain some weight back. But I think it's important for people in this country who are so well-fed, oftentimes too well-fed, that we look at what we take for granted and what we think is normal and natural. For us to think that we can't miss a meal or miss a day of food, actually that's not true, and it can be a very, very healthy thing. And we might need the practice down the line, just as Mamie was talking about having to project without the microphone. We're going to have to rethink everything about the way we live. I neglected to thank the Neighbors for Peace and Justice. I know John Elke, tremendous activist, and other people who have been very helpful for the project. And for me are Lois Arkin, who is here from LA Eco Village. Please stand up, Lois. And Eric Einem of LAPostCarbon.org, a very effective activist. I don't know where he is. Please stand up, Eric. And he has a table out there, PostCarbon, and I've got some of my materials out there. I have some CDs of the eco songs that I do. And you can sign up to get our new newsletter as well. For tomorrow, before I forget to mention it, there is an event at the South Central Community Farm, which is right near the Blue Line Vernon Metro stop. And yes, Jerry, there is a subway in Los Angeles. We had fun on the radio on KPFK yesterday. And that's at 41st and Long Beach, 2 o'clock. And it's very important that we nurture local urban agriculture and farming in this town, just like Havana. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I'm going to give a little eco concert for people who like folk music. One of the organizers will be there as well. It's important that this particular farm be defended because it's in danger from being paved over for a warehouse project. And City Hall has done a deal with the landowner. It's all quite questionable, but you can learn more about that on lapostcarbon.org, and culturechange.org is covering some of that as well. I often am thought to be somebody who enjoys giving out a scary message. I used to be warned never to mention depaving because paving moratorium was too radical, but things have caught up to me, and now I've got to be radical enough to keep pace with the times because things are changing fast. Peak oil is a geological concept that's irrefutable, and we've had lots of evidence for it suggesting that it'll be probably this year or the next, but when exactly it's hitting isn't the point. So our group and a lot of the people I work with have been talking about petrol collapse instead because it talks about the next phase. Now, instead of doing this, instead of talking about something which can be scary, and I do hasten to mention the upsides of all this, the optimistic part of it, hell, I'd rather be gardening or playing guitar or, doing any number of things, enjoying my family. But I have learned something about the oil industry, and I was an activist for an even longer time, trying to staunch the growth of the petroleum industries. So for understanding peak oil, I think we can look at the unappreciated role of the market. And what the market does is exacerbate this geological reality greatly, because you have the prices going through the roof and you have hoarding. Now, hoarding takes the fuel out of circulation. Tanks are topped off. The consumer accounts, institutions, commercial tanks, and of course, the motorists. when the tanks are topped off, this upsets the balance of the market and fuel just isn't available because people think that the price is going to be higher the next day or not available at all. So you get this exaggerated effect. And we are going to see that, except in the 1970s, this was in an environment of rising global oil extraction. And this is going to be a global phenomenon. Now, evidence for peak is quite thorough, but people are thrown off by some strange projections or rumors or misunderstandings that maybe peak is 20 or more years off. I hate to break it to you, but the Energy Information Administration, part of the Department of Energy, based their number of the peak of oil extraction occurring after 2020 based on demand projections. So that's what they do. They just assume that the market will take care of everything and that technology will solve everything. But a lot of things you hear about from organizations paid to say these things, such as enhanced recovery, this takes a lot of energy to get that out. And we hear about the tar sands of Alberta, that there's more than the Persian Gulf there. Well, this is like a solid material, tremendous amounts of energy, natural gas, which is in decline in this continent, and vast amounts of water and terrible amounts of pollution are created. The projection for the maximum output of tar sands in Alberta would be about 5 million barrels per day. Well, that is substantial, but that's compared to our global demand of 84 million barrels a day. So is that some kind of a, you know, panacea? No, it's not going to happen. I would like to now burst the bubble of renewable energy. Renewable energy is great. And when we walk and ride our bikes, those are some of the most prime and sustainable examples. One thing that was not in the Cuba film is that to get around and solve the problem of transportation, it went heavily bike-oriented. So there are a lot of cheap, heavy bikes there. And that was, you know, the other part of the whole petroleum, the conversion getting away from petroleum. In this country, we think of oil mainly for gasoline. But obviously, it's for our food production, too. And we are so hooked on petroleum for a number of things that we don't really realize it. I believe the material of these chairs is petroleum, the bottoms of our shoes. But when you look at renewable energy, is it going to give us the farm chemicals or the asphalt or the tires or the plastics? The answer is no. You can generate a lot of electricity through renewable energy, but you put it into the grid and you have these transmission lines that lose so much after, you know, a short distance that it becomes rather inefficient. So renewable energy is going to be a very decentralized affair, a decentralized phenomenon, and that will characterize our whole society. So it's going to be societies, economies. It's going to be local, bioregional entities where we're not getting our oranges from Florida in California, which does happen, nor will we be getting marching orders from 3,000 miles away in Washington. We're going to have to be managing for ourselves, running our own communities, and this is the upside of petrocollapse, because it isn't just doom and gloom that we won't be able to drive so much anymore or eat food that took 15 times as much energy than the energy we get out of it when we eat it, or that traveled over 1,200 miles, the average piece of food in this country, or, you know, grapes in winter from South America, this kind of thing. There is going to be hardship. It is going to be an extremely difficult and questionable prospect for a vast population fed by petroleum, the food distributed by petroleum, people who are not any longer used to taking care of themselves. In World War II, the people led the way with victory gardens, and that was depaving. It was tearing up lawns, growing our food locally, and it was almost half as many people in those days. The country started to go petrochemical and petroleum fuel starting in around 1930. People got used to what they call progress, but we become these consumers, and the very term implies helplessness and isolation and greed and unconsciousness. But we are going to be losing this isolated consumer culture. We're going to have to get to know our neighbors, make for local food production, and we're going to be taking care of one another. Why drive children miles and miles to be, in effect, raised by strangers most of the day? What about educating our own children? What about taking care of our elders in our own communities? What about the grandparents teaching children? What a concept. Doesn't happen much in this country anymore. It's a good thing I talked to my mother, who's 85, who told me only a couple of years ago that they created a refrigerator in the farmhouse in Idaho by digging a giant hole in the ground in the kitchen. So people are going to have to relearn a lot of these things. So sustainable living is where it's at. Fortunately, there are a lot of people learning about sustainable living and practicing it. And these people are the ones leading the way without much recognition, and it's a matter of censorship in the corporate media for people to hear about car-free living or actually sharing refrigerators, sharing ovens, not having a TV, not having a computer. I lived for years without a refrigerator. It works fine. And that can be most of your electricity use, depending on what kind of a refrigerator you have. But all these things make us wealthier, in a sense, spiritually anyway. So not to have all these material things that isolate us, and for every room to have these appliances and gadgets and all the global warming electronic contraptions that are brought over from China with oil for the ships. World trade is going to collapse. We're going to have to be getting what we need from our own ecosystems. We're going to have to live within ecological carrying capacity. So big changes are afoot, and I think a lot of people in this room are aware of it. So I'm looking forward to culture change. We're going to have a much more convivial and active and mutual aid-oriented cooperative society, and this is only a good thing. So if we can think about what needs to be done and keep our eye on the ball of what's ahead and try to create the future that we want, this is what our current leaders really don't want us to do. They want to appear as in charge and competent, but we saw with Katrina and Rita that the government isn't really there to help us necessarily, or are they competent to do so? And those events did knock out a lot of petroleum production, which is still offline. But we might as well think of the whole country as possibly one giant New Orleans awaiting us. Now, that was a petroleum disaster in many ways. Not only was a lot of pollution created from the petroleum facilities getting hit hard, but you had the hurricane's force generated in part from the climate change, which you can call oil company weather if you want. So there's going to be more of that because global warming is out of control. More CO2 and methane are getting into the atmosphere than is being accounted for by the emissions that had been tracked. 2005 is the hottest year in known history, and we have more of that ahead. One of the projects that we worked on up in Arcata with what was the Sustainable Energy Institute, which is now culturechange.org, was the Pledge for Climate Stabilization, or Pledge for Climate Protection, as it was later renamed. And I think there might be some time during our long question period when I can go down what that pledge was. Some of the other projects we did, I'd like to call to your attention. Pedal Power Produce. Now, what that was, and still is in a few places in this country, is going to organic farm, loading up your bike carts and bike trailers, and peddling it to the farmers' markets. And we were doing it 9 miles up in Humboldt County, and it was really fun. The pedal power produce farm is physically still there. It's still organic, but that project really couldn't quite get going when people just found it so convenient to go to the co-op or, Safeway. But one day the trucks are not going to be coming into the co-op and Safeway. And that very prediction was put out in Congress by Roscoe Bartlett from the representative from Maryland. He was quoting me in the floor of Congress about the trucks not rolling in anymore. I was quite shocked. And he's a Republican. So I think we may have a convergence. If the Democrats aren't telling us about peak oil and a Republican is, fine, I'll work with anybody. So the old labels of liberal, conservative, right, left, Democrat, Republican, that really isn't where it's at. We have to have a convergence, and I think it's starting. So we will be coming together and dropping the old differences. And I think a lot of people are going to be looking more kindly on those naughty Cubans, for example. Let me spend a little more time on renewable energy. This is something which is supposed to be the answer, but we need to question why we need the energy in the first place. So radical conservation is my message. It's not a very fundable message, but the large environmental groups have found that singing the song of the technofix and saying that our problems will be solved because we'll have clean cars powered by wind energy. This is a very irresponsible and untrue kind of scenario. And there are a number of very talented energy analysts and environmentalists who identify the problem beautifully, but the solution is completely fantastical. And I would have to say it includes Amory Lovins and Jeremy Rifkin, Lester Brown, Ross Gelbspan, tremendously intelligent people. We need to question the so-called solutions to peak oil, petrol collapse, and think about the problem being cultural rather than energy or technology problem. So we can do this together if we think in terms of emergency mitigation. If the government's not doing it for you, if the corporations are not really practicing it, and the free market isn't giving us these answers, then it does come down to us. And that gets us into the area of activism. My daughter put out a record called It's Up to Us. And just to give you a little morale boost in the area of activism, she and our friends sued the police up in Humboldt for their torturing teenage kids with pepper spray in the eye with Q-tips. They were locked down in sit-ins for the fast-dwindling ancient redwoods. And so that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and there was a victory in April, so that as protesters, you will not and cannot be tortured in this country. And there's more to be done with activism. We can get together and form affinity groups. These are very strong, non-hierarchical kinds of organization that help us decide what's going to be our action tonight, or what are we doing tomorrow, or our group will do this, that group will do that. And that can be any number of things, depaving, or it can be research. So there's a lot to do. Many, many things can be done. And most of us are just scratching the surface. It's great to drive a more efficient car, fine, but it's barely the beginning. There's so much more to be done. We have to get ready for petrol collapse. And it isn't all doom and gloom. And I hope that you'll agree that, you know, although we're divided now, we are going to be having to come together, and no longer will a segment of the population, such as the poor and the homeless, be treated as subhuman or something like that. And incidentally, the street people know how to survive a lot better than a lot of well-heeled consumers these days. Now, I would like to yield the floor with a little bit of hope and urging you to reach out to your family, your neighbors, talk about this issue. And don't write off all the politicians. We have some very good ones. And if you get busy with letters to the editor, if you take action and realize that the power is within you, then great good is going to come of this, and we don't have to be so afraid. So thank you very much. Look forward to talking with you later.
This first is for Jan Lundberg. Whenever alternative energy is talked about, nuclear energy is always proposed as a solution. What are your thoughts about the use of nuclear energy, and do you think it's a viable option?
Nuclear is the opposite of viable in every imaginable way. Uranium is a limited resource, a pollutant that ought to stay in the ground, actually. Same with petroleum. But for the purposes of understanding an energy economy, we're talking about something that only produces electricity, and it isn't very efficient because so much energy has to go into making most forms of energy that it just doesn't compare to cheap oil. So, and limiting this to electricity, which doesn't supply various things that petroleum does, then we're talking about something that isn't going to be enabling the consumer economy to keep going forever.
Okay. Jan, I think the second part of the question was, is there a lot of oil that's being kept off the market? In other words, is there a lot of gaming of the market that is interfering with the perception, probably, of peak oil?
I don't believe it works that way. The oil business just wants to keep doing what it's doing. Unfortunately, there's a myth being perpetrated that tells us that there's so much oil in the Middle East that the Persian Gulf countries and OPEC will be in complete control, more so and more so and more so. But the overstatement of reserves that Jerry mentioned is definitely something that we need to sort of apply to that whole region. And the whole idea of this predominance of the Middle East. Now, there are reasons for this. Israel likes to say there's so much oil there, the foreign policy becomes critical towards Israel because they're a bastion of pro-American democracy there. So we get some inflated ideas from that sector. The oil companies want people to believe, well, alternative fuels really don't have much of a future. There's so much oil, so much oil. So there has been this overstatement. Now, there are reasons for OPEC countries to lie about their reserves and for U.S. oil companies and British oil companies to lie about their reserves, too. Previously, the quota system, which is not really operative anymore that much for OPEC, they wanted to jack up what they could sell, the amount they could sell, so they overstated. Also, you get more loans when you have more assets, and also, in general, to keep alternatives squelched. So for these reasons, oil has always been maximized. But no matter how much oil there might be in Iraq or that whole area, it's important for people to realize that peak oil is not going to be affected by some big discovery somewhere or some oil field or nation coming fully online. Peak is a general trend that cannot be changed at this point. Mm-hmm. Discoveries peaked in the world around 1964. It's been downhill ever since then. It's not really going to change. For Iraq's production capabilities and marketing capabilities, sabotage is a real factor there. The resistance movement against the occupation and world trade, perhaps, there are many motivations for this to be kept down. And oil is produced in less quantity than it was under Saddam Hussein just before he was taken out. So I think those, you know, all those things need to be considered with the Iraq picture. It's mainly a gigantic tragedy of violence that, you know, as long as we have fuel here that we need and we're enjoying all this energy and products, then people don't care that much. But if the U.S. wants to become popular again around the world, respected again around the world, and not a rogue and renegade nation for its treatment of the climate, and if terrorism is to be avoided, then maximum conservation. As soon as this country starts to use very little fuel, a lot of people around the world aren't going to be mad at this nation anymore.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Are you still involved in pro-rail, pro-Amtrak advocacy? Important since Bush GOP have Amtrak in their crosshairs. My pro-Amtrak slogan, I think, therefore I Amtrak. It's great. It's great.
Well, just by using it publicly, and I wrote an essay that's going to be in the next Permaculture Activist magazine coming out next week called My Amtrak Peak Oil Tour. Just bring your own food and water. The beer, some of the beer is okay on Amtrak. I'm not really active in transportation issues that much anymore, just trying to get a handle on petroleum and cultural change is really plenty. But on the archive part of the culturechange.org website, which used to be the Auto Free Times, there's really a lot on, you know, Amtrak, cars, things like that. The energy savings from a full train is the best deal going. However, there is very little prospect for renewable energy for trains. And this is something that I've been looking for, hoping for, doing a little research, trying to publish something on it. It's not happening. And it probably won't happen. The time to convert our petroleum infrastructure to something different or a steady state economy, that chance was back in the 1970s. It takes so long to regear, retool, and replace an infrastructure. There is not time for this. And that's what the Hirsch report that you saw mentioned in the movie on Cuba is about, that he warned that when we have a peak upon us, it is really too late to make the kinds of basic changes for energy and materials in our infrastructure and land use to really deal with that. And let me add that Hirsch did a more recent study on the experience of other countries with their peak oil production. He found that it really is not a bell curve, that the peak is sharp, it comes without warning, and the decline is very steep.
And the question that was here is, what's your next step for peak oil, and what do you think there is value in saving petroleum for while we transit?
For my step, I think going car-free is probably my favorite, most often mentioned suggestion. Part of the reason is that cars really, I mean, the American motorist is really only going about 5 miles per hour, because you have to take into account all the time involved in earning the money to buy the car, to fix the car, the insurance, the fuel, everything. So you compare all this time that isn't just, you know, zooming along to the distance covered, and it comes to about 5 miles per hour. Thank you, Ivan Illich, who wrote that up in 1973. For energy, remaining fossil fuel power for what it might be used for, this is discussed by folks who see the end of an era coming. And some talk about how it should be applied to building renewable energy systems. My favorite is restoration, because we have all these roads eroding into the salmon stream. We need, you know, these rivers and streams. We have to have the salmon come back. We have to eat those fish, you know. So restoration, and it takes a tremendous amount of power to do that, trying to do all that by hand. Anyway, it's going to be great employment. There are going to be a lot of important jobs in doing that, and communities will support that. You know, with available energy, it's also important to realize that energy isn't necessarily going to be that abundant or productive, because energy profit ratio, how much you get out of the energy put into something, and one of the questions we're not going to get to, but alcohol fuels, it's a wash. You have to put as much energy into the process as you get out, roughly speaking. Renewables tend to be that way compared to the era of cheap oil. So we're definitely entering a new phase.
You have been listening to Jan Lundberg as he spoke about petrocollapse at a forum held at the Valley Cities Jewish Community Center in Sherman Oaks, California, on January 28th of 2006. The full program of music, film, and a panel was presented by Neighbors for Peace and Justice of the San Fernando Valley. Jan Lundberg is an oil industry analyst, founder of Auto Free Times, and Culture Change, which can be found at www.culturechange.org. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.